Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody. Hello, and welcome to this podcast here on this wonderful August morning. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Chris Schaller. He is the CEO of a leading managed security services provider, known as Christo IT. Now, they're based in Harleysville, Pennsylvania. Chris, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Awesome. Thank you for having me this morning. Great to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you. We did a little bit of snooping on you on Google and on LinkedIn. You seem to have a really good background in cybersecurity and your education and everything. Can you first tell us a little bit more about your background, your careers, and the highlights, and what made you get started in cybersecurity?
Sure. I started Christo IT back in 1999. And the general idea was to provide small businesses with access to enterprise-level help, IT support. And we started really focusing a little bit more on cybersecurity, I would say, about 4 years ago. We always did the basics. We always provided, you know, the antivirus, the backup, the encryption, things of that nature. But about 4 years ago, we started seeing a lot of changes.
Okay.
Some of those changes that we're seeing, some of those changes we're seeing are you saw it with GDPR the DFS 500 law in New York in 2018. Those are kind of, I would view them almost as beachheads. Like those are the first flag in the sand that you're putting in place. And, we started really starting to pay attention to where, the trajectory of those either laws or directions or, governances were coming from.
Now, how did you venture into Christo IT? What was your motivating factor behind it? And is this a company that you've helped to, you know, start from scratch?
The whole concept was help. That's our governing focus, and it's really, it governs everything that we do is to help, to be. I coined a phrase that a friend gave to me years ago. To have that servant's heart to help people that need technology in some way, shape, or form to advance their own goals, their own needs in what their businesses are. And the clients that we provide services to are they're mostly professional firms, small businesses in the Philadelphia area and surrounding areas. But we have branch offices actually around the world now for helping our clients take care of their IT infrastructure.
Okay, excellent. You've been in business since 1999, correct, you said?
Since 1999, yep.
Oh.
Started it with a laptop and a prayer, Ravi.
Oh, wow. It kind of sounds like where I started with my tech writing gig here a few about 10, 12 years ago, too. But how has business been for you? I mean, have there been challenges like the dot-com bust and then COVID-19 and then we had a great recession? How has it been for you in the last, 20 years or so?
We thankfully have had very steady, progressive growth through those 20 years. We've done a couple of acquisitions of some other IT firms and grown through that method. But for the most part, it's mostly been organic growth, word of mouth, a little bit of advertising, some networking, things of that nature. But it's been there were a couple of times where we did have to change how we were operating with our clients, but for the most part, it's been a very positive journey.
Okay, excellent. Now, how did you get the name Christo IT? It sounds like it's a very unique name. When I think of that name, I kind of conjure up like a James Bond movie, kind of, sort of. So how did you get that game? I'm just curious. It really piqued my curiosity.
People have always asked us that. I wish I had a better story for you. I'm not Greek. I'm very Irish by heritage. A little bit of French, a little bit of Irish. Not Greek. And we're not a religious organization. Christo came from Christopher, and way back in the day, you could only fit like 7 characters in the field. And it cut off Christo at Christo, and that stuck.
Okay. Now I see it. Okay. Gotcha. I think there was that one James Bond movie, I think, where he was in Greece. I think that's where I connected it to. I can't remember exactly where.
Oh, okay. I remember the guy with the eye that bleeds and Casino Royale, or is that Christo, I think, or something like that?
No.
No affiliation to any James Bond villains.
Okay.
I don't own a cat. I don't own a white cat or anything like that.
Okay. Well, I own a white cat actually. But anyway, okay.
Do you really? That's awesome.
Yeah, she's a beautiful little kitty, green eyes and all white, like a little big polar bear. But anyway. Who is your typical customer base? I mean, you mentioned the SMBs, but do you target like the Fortune 500 and the government entities for perhaps the local and state levels too as well?
We focus entirely on the small business, the small business network. So our clients range from, we're typically under 200 seats from the customers that we support. Our average client is a 40 person firm that is in a professional office, like an accountant, a lawyer, a retirement investment advisor. Those are the types of clients that we support.
Okay. Well, one question I want to ask you is that there is this disparity gap in cybersecurity. A lot of other vendors I've interviewed on podcasts, a lot of other MSPs, MSSPs, they don't want to touch the SMB market because they don't think, for lack of a better term, that there's enough money to be made from it. And likewise, the SMBs think, the other vendors are too expensive. So how have you bridged that gap? You know what I'm talking about?
That is a great question. And part of that goes back to what we were just talking about a couple minutes ago. For the most part, we've followed the best practices out there for small businesses and really checked the boxes of what we considered our core security options. So antivirus, backup, a firewall, intrusion protection, like the basics of, combing your hair and brushing your teeth kind of idea. What we've seen in that gap that you're talking about between enterprise level and SMB level, the bad guys, the hackers are they either have known or maybe the tool sets that they're using are allowing for more attack vectors into the SMB market because there's less protections there typically. So the level of attacks in the SMB space have increased almost exponentially. And I think our customer base is seeing that. And the awareness has really, really, really increased over the past 2 years. We're getting questions about it. Our clients are asking to sit down with us and have further discussions about where can I increase my protection? Where am I vulnerable? What this is keeping me up at night? What do I need to worry about here? I know you guys take care of us, but what else do I need to think about either for my business or for my employees?
Mm-hmm. So would you say the SMB market is still kind of very much an untapped market for cybersecurity?
Very much so. I think it's I think the lights have come on. I really feel like we're getting a lot of traction. We recently just sat down with the majority of our clients and kind of walked through what our roadmap is going to look like. And this was all geared around cybersecurity. And the everybody seems to be paying attention because of how frontline and how many headlines that you're seeing out there.
Right. Excellent. Okay. Now, you mentioned that you made some improvements to your product and service line. What are some of these changes? I know that you focus exclusively on, like, legal and the financial, you know, like this, the financial advisors and accounts. What changes have you made to your product stack?
So we've added on cybersecurity is always about layers. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir on that one, aren't I? We've added on a few layers on this, and as I mentioned, we kind of have always followed best practices and what our clients are getting asked for from either their governance or their customers and what they're asking for, and we've kind of made sure that we've been watching the winds and where things are going. Recently, though, to answer your question, we've added on a number of different layers of things that we've seen, and here's where I tell you, I was really wrong on this, and I'm one of the first to admit it. I mentioned earlier in the podcast the DFS 500 and the GDPR, and we were under the assumption with those things coming that most of the change was going to be legislative in nature, so that we were going to see we're here in the Philadelphia area and New York, things that get adopted in New York, usually you give it a little bit of time and there's some sort of adoption within to the Philadelphia range or the New Jersey range. And it happens geographically and legislative ideas kind of move out into the different state legislatures. So we were under that impression of this is where things were, this is the tail that was going to wag the dog. And I was really wrong on this, because what we've seen explosively so has been changes in the insurance industry. Cybersecurity insurance being one of the primary ones, but even from a general umbrella policy or an errors and omissions or business insurance policies, they are all pointing towards data protection. And the changes that we have seen come through on that, and I can talk a little bit more about that, but have been absolutely explosive over the past 12 months.
Right. Oh, wow, okay. Well, that brings up another question. I've just written a book on cybersecurity risk and insurance, you know, coincidentally speaking. It's coming out here in a couple of weeks at the end of September. Yeah, and cybersecurity insurance, I would say it's probably worse than shopping for healthcare insurance. At least, you know, for example, like my wife and I were on Obamacare, so it's a little easier. But, you know, I still have to deal with the healthcare marketplace, and they're not the easiest of people to deal with sometimes. They don't quite get it. But with cybersecurity risk insurance, that's from what I've seen, I'm not an expert on it, although I've written the book, but it seems like it's just so confusing and so hard to get, because an SMB owner thinks, well, hey, you know, I've got this insurance policy, you know, whatever happens, I'm going to get covered. But 99%, that's not the case. You're not going to get the payout. And one thing I've learned is that with all these ransomware attacks, these insurance companies, they're not giving the payout if you paid, you know, that ransom to the cyber attacking group. Why is it so hard for someone to figure out what they need in insurance policy? And in that regard, do you recommend that for like an SMB owner to get like a lawyer or kind of like a broker who knows what they're doing to help them decide what they want?
You absolutely need to talk to somebody that has some experience in this area. You can always talk to an IT professional, somebody like Christo IT. You can talk to your business attorney, would give you a general idea of perhaps what surface area, what risk you have externally. Your insurance broker, you absolutely should pick based on how much cyber insurance that they do. You should really ask the blunt question, is this something that you guys handle internally? Have you handled this before? Because not to be disparaging, but your local State Farm or Geico representative, whoever you handle your regular insurance for, is really just going to turn around and outsource this to somebody else because they don't have the internal resources to do this. Yeah. They're turning around and using a different underwriter or a different carrier that they normally don't go through. This is not an everyday, at least not yet. It's not an everyday thing for them, so they really don't have as much exposure to it. And they're probably not asking you the right questions to make sure that you're getting, like you said, you could be buying something that is not really going to give you the coverage that you need. It's kind of a fruitless exercise if you're not actually going to get a little bit deep dive into this.
Right. Well, do you know of any insurance companies that have those internal resources? Are we talking like the Allstates, the Nationwide, or Hiscox kind of insurance companies?
I know there are a couple specialty companies out there. And some of the things that in conversations that we've had with insurance brokers who are specializing in cybersecurity, the marketplace for this, the number of insurance providers that are doing this is shrinking rapidly. So there is going to be some specialization that happens over the next couple of years. I'm not an insurance guy. I don't claim to know anything about this, but the number of for instance, AIG, who is like the 800-pound gorilla in the room, they've recently said something along the lines of, we're only going to co-insure people 50%, which is a fairly big statement in the industry. This is not business that we're going after. So I think you're going to see companies like Crum & Foster or Tokio Marine, people who are really getting deep into the cyber insurance that are really going to be – they're going to know what to ask for, and they're going to know how to have conversations with you, the right answers to provide you with the insurance that you protect. And some of that is going to be conversations with your IT provider, like Cristo IT. So on average, we're probably having two or three different conversations with our clients each week about either they're getting they're putting in an application for insurance, or one of their clients is asking about data and where it's being held and how it's being taken care of.
Wow. Okay. Now, your product stack, are they like an on-prem solution, or are they in the cloud? Like for example, Microsoft Azure, the AWS.
Yes. Now we use we're a Microsoft shop, so we're a Microsoft Gold partner, and most of our cloud providers are in Microsoft Azure cloud hosting. Some of the layers that we're adding. So one of the changes that we've seen, to give you an example, is the cyber insurance applications are no longer just simply asking for antivirus. They're now asking for either a next generation antivirus or something like EDR, which is endpoint detection and response. And that's one of the changes that we've seen over this past year. And endpoint detection and response, it has that cloud aspect to it where it's not just plain old antivirus anymore. It now has a cloud-based artificial intelligence behind it so that you're not only just looking for virus definitions, you're also looking for pattern recognition. You also have human beings behind this that are also looking for pattern recognition and are making remediation steps if we do see something that's wrong. So there's a little bit of a combination on most of these layers that have some of that cloud backing along with an on-premise solution. So we're seeing a little bit of a hybrid go on there.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I've tried to use Microsoft Azure. Isn't it kind of expensive for like an SMB maybe to a certain degree? Because aren't there virtual machines kind of, they charge you like by the minute or so? I was kind of curious about that. What are your thoughts on that? Like when you spin up a virtual machine, it's simple.
Oh, it can be. We've gotten really over. We started hosting in Azure about 5 years ago now. It's always utility based, so you pay for what you use, which is nice. We've gotten very, very good about a couple of different things. You can have you can sign up for multi-year situations. You can have some variability, so you don't your server's not, so for instance your server's not running hot, so to speak, 24 hours a day. You can have things where, like in the off hours, you can actually throttle that down and really reduce your footprint and reduce your cost significantly. So we've gotten really kind of good about seeing some of the different ways. So you don't have that CapEx of buying an actual iron server that goes in your back closet, you have an ongoing operational cost. But over time, we found that while there might be a little bit of extra cost, maybe about 20% or so over if you take a lifespan of a server like 5 or 6 years, it really they have made it palatable to be able to use the cloud option, be it Azure or AWS or something else, and really take that heavy cost of capital expenditure out of it and make it an operational expenditure.
Oh, okay, excellent. Now, can you tell us some more about the technical architecture that you use in Azure? I mean, are we talking like hybrid clouds, public clouds, private clouds, combination of both? What do your SMBs, do your clients really tend to prefer? What do you recommend to them for their cloud infrastructure?
We have all of our clients in a private cloud, so we don't have anything that's cohabitated or multi-tenant. We have them all wrapped up, for lack of a better term, individually. We're able to make changes because each of our clients are operating in different worlds and in different methodologies, and we're able to make those changes. So client A is able to, hey, you know what, we just added a bunch of people to our system. We're able to throttle them up and give them the extra resources that and make those kind of changes on an individual basis.
Okay, excellent. Now, email protection, email security has always been around. In fact, I believe the first phishing attack on an email platform was way back, I think, in 1999 on AOL, if I'm correct. Now, email phishing, email security, that has evolved so much in the last 20 years. How do you protect email? What do you use to protect the email services for your clients?
So we use a sandboxing technique. So you can use something like I believe the Office. Most of our clients are in Microsoft Office 365, and Office 365 has an add-on product called Advanced Threat Protection. I think they call it Microsoft Defender now. You can use that. Right. You can use another product called Proofpoint. That provides the same kind of idea, but the sandboxing of that email and what I mean by that is before when the email gets sent to you, the whatever service that you use, be it Microsoft Defender or Proofpoint or something similar, they actually will examine anything that's in that email before it even gets delivered to you. So they're looking at those links, those potential malicious links in there. They're looking at any attachments. If you have a Word document or an Excel document or a Santa Claus screensaver attachment or whatever. They're looking at those and actually opening up those. When I say opening up, there's not anybody actually sitting there and clicking on them. It's automated, but they're opening up that email in a sandbox and making sure that there's nothing actually untoward that's actually happening. So it's not launching something. It's not trying to direct you to a malicious website. They check for that. And then once you get the green checkbox and everything's okay, then it delivers it to your inbox and makes it available for you to read. Now, what I just described there happened in nanoseconds. You barely even register a delay. But that goes both inbound and outbound, because some people forget that sometimes there's as much risk coming from inside your own organization, and you got to make sure that everything going out the door is safe as well. So we find that to be really, really helpful, and has been for all the education in the world. We have done so much with our end users as far as education and training them to be, hover your mouse over any links, and we've done a fantastic job of that over the past 5 or 6 years that we've really been focused on it. But even with all of that education and hammering home how much dangerous stuff is out there, you still have a click on a malicious link every once in a while, because we send those training, those phishing training emails out to our clients. And for everything, all the education, occasionally we still have people that fail the test.
Well, I think I was a contractor at Northern Trust Bank. Of all things, being an IT security tech writer, and I'm kind of ashamed to say I fell prey for one of those training emails too, I think. So it's, yeah, anyway. But, so how about mobile security, like your iPhone or Samsung Android device? What do you how do you protect that?
Definitely becoming a hot button. It is.
Yeah. One thing is in the downloading mobile apps. I don't have any mobile apps on my cell phone. I only have one for my email because, honestly, Chris, as much as I write about technology and we talk about it, I hate technology. I hate mobile apps and everything that goes with it. And just for a standpoint of security, because I know that Apple is a lot better about safeguarding the apps that get uploaded by developers, but Google is not nearly as watchful as Apple is. So what are your thoughts on all this?
It's really, really dynamic. What we have seen and part of the reason for me being a little wishy-washy on this is dealing with the SMB market like we do, our clients have all of them have very different approaches to this. We have some clients that provide their cell phones for their employees. We have other clients who it's just bring your own device. Whatever cell phone you bring, we'll get you set up with email and so forth and so on. So we kind of try and make things available from security. We've had great success with Microsoft Intune product that helps lock things down, that makes sure that even in a bring your own device scenario, you're able to set up certain hoops that the end user needs to adhere to before they have access to, for instance, your Office 365 account on your cell phone. So both Mass, I think Mass 360 is another good option as well. But as far as application protection, I don't know that Intune and Mass 360 are good options. They're a little bit pricey options for the SMB market, and I think that probably is going to come down, and that probably is going to be the next that's going to be the next phase of adoption in SMB, is that mobile device.
Okay, excellent. Now, what are your thoughts about the mobile app security? What do you tell your clients on that? How do you tell them to be careful? Because, Chris, I mean, it's so hard to tell these days with the malicious app, what's a real app, and so forth. In fact, before we got on, I was telling about my fight with Verizon, and they said, oh, yeah, go to our mobile app. I said, look, I don't have any mobile apps. It's for security. How do you tell clients what to look for when downloading apps?
If you're in the Apple world, we tell people that you got to look for that developer. You got to make sure that you actually have a legitimate website behind that developer. You actually have a rating system behind that developer. Same thing with Google Play. You really should be looking at that, where that developer is coming from. Do they have support? Do they have a website? Do they have a phone number that you can call if you need support? If you look in the App Store and you see like three reviews, and when you click on the developer's web link, it takes you to some place that's you don't even recognize. Your warning bells should be on high alert.
Yeah. Well, of course, a lot of the problem, I think, is the security of the source code, too. You know, a lot of these software developers, they use third-party open-source APIs, and because of that, a lot of them are not tested. You know, they're not updated. I think that's where a lot of the backdoors start to, you know, precipitate in that regard. But it's just so hard to tell anymore. I guess maybe my way is the best way. I just don't download anything, but there'll probably be a lot of people out there.
Caution is the best practice, absolutely.
I'm probably extreme, but honestly, I don't get in all these mobile apps. But anyway, now how about IAM, Identity and Access Authentication Services? We're hearing things now about, like, you know, the buzzword was two-factor authentication, then we heard multi-factor authentication, now we're hearing about the Zero Trust Framework. You know, I mean, all these big buzzwords, and the ZTF, I think, is starting to become adopted by businesses in corporate America, but it's a very extreme approach, too, I think. What are your thoughts on that, and have you made use of biometrics? Because when I originally got started in security, that's where I got my feet wet, was naturally in biometrics. I'm doing stuff in hand recognition and fingerprint recognition. Can you please tell us your thoughts on that?
I think it's one of the best things, and it's one of the best things going, and things like the facial recognition option in on cell phones, and that option makes the option of security easier for people. I think the best way to get adoption on this and to make it as mainstream and as painless as possible is to get that, make it as pain-free and as smooth as possible so that people don't have to worry about it. They don't have to think about it, because if we make it as that mainstream as we possibly can, that's going to be our best bet into making things go forward. So the biometrics in two-factor authentication, we use, again, not to sound like a broken record, we use a combination of Microsoft Authenticator, which uses either facial ID or you know, a two-factor authentication code. But it makes the process as simple as just looking at your cell phone and verifying that it is you who's actually logging into the PC. And to make it that smooth of a process where you simply just have to glance at your device to make sure that you're logging in and it is you who is logging in, makes these additional layers of security that we're talking about adding on less painful for the end users and a greater adoption rate. So the best security is getting everybody on board and not having any exclusions. And that's going to make things safer for everybody.
Okay. Well, what are your thoughts on iris recognition? Because I know COVID and all that, a lot of people are afraid to, you know, touch things like with fingerprint recognition. But I know that there are a lot of other solutions out there that are non-contactless with fingerprinting, you know, like vein pattern recognition. But iris recognition, I would think that would make more headway, because the iris is like one of the most rich in terms of unique identifiers, and the structure of the eye really hardly ever changes during the lifetime of an individual. And what are your thoughts about iris recognition?
I always like to see a little bit more of data points before I make judgments on that. I like the idea because it is something that can stay with you. My only question mark that I have on this is where is the data? Am I holding on to that data? Is that something that I control? Am I able to move it? Am I able to make sure that if I'm no longer using this provider, that that data gets removed? Similar to what GDPR has done over in Europe is like, I'm giving you permission, and as soon as I revoke that permission, you have to get rid of everything. So as long as that type of new technology, along with any new technology, Robbie. So, I mean, I would probably say this with anything that's coming along new like this. As long as I have control over it as an end user, as somebody who has protection of myself, I'm very on board with it. I just want to make sure that there's it's not getting uploaded to somewhere that I don't have control over my own self.
Okay, excellent. Well, a side story about the iris recognition is that I don't know if you remember, like way back when, this National Geographic photographer, I think his name is Mike McCurry, took a picture of this one Afghan girl. You know, she had those striking green eyes and was on the. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I actually do.
They actually found her 20 years later somewhere in Afghanistan. It all came down to iris recognition and confirming her identity. And that was really an incredible story. But anyway, that's just a side thing. Anyway, so basically,
pretty darn amazing.
Yeah. It came from a company called Iridian Technologies. They held all the patents and all the algorithms for it. But after all that expired, you've seen a plethora of iris recognition vendors come out. And actually, it was Dr. John Dogman at Cambridge. He created all these algorithms. It's all based upon, like, I think what they call Gabor wavelet mathematics. But anyway, I'm getting off on the deep end here. But anyway, now when you deal with, I just get into all these mathematical algorithms. But anyway, now another, I mean, how can we not forget this one or ignore it? Ransomware. I mean, every day there's something coming out of ransomware. And honestly, it's been made famous because of the SolarWinds attack. The attack on the exchange servers. Now we're seeing supply chain attacks. Where the cyber attacker is using this one weak spot to infiltrate thousands of other people, other victims. How have you dealt with all that? Being a Microsoft shop, and they had that one printing hack too, I think, if I remember correctly, just a few weeks ago or a month ago.
Yes, yeah, a couple of weeks ago, the printing hack, and thankfully we only had a couple of clients that actually had that printer available, and we were able to lock those down until the gap was fixed, so to speak. I'm really knocking on wood when I say this. We have had relatively little exposure with ransomware. We've had a couple of incidents that have thankfully been small, and we've been able to do like restorations from backup and kind of wipe and lock down and do a serious scan afterwards. But thankfully, it's been small. One of the things that we've really been preaching on this is for all of the IT layers that we've put on, that zero trust that we were talking about. We put on EDR. We put on all of these layers. Even with all of this, some of the education that we're doing are things that are really outside of IT. Things like, have you called your bank and made sure that you have a process for wire transfers, and that you need to have a conversation with your banker about making sure that you're verifying by two different people any wire transfers. That's something that's it's going to take you 15 minutes and have a conversation with your bank representative, And it doesn't have anything to do with IT, but it's one of the greatest surface areas that they're attacking, is something that is almost analog in nature. But yeah, we've had relatively minor exposure with this. One of the key things that was brought up to me probably about 2 or 3 years ago, and we preach this to our clients, because some of our clients in SMB world, one of the reactions that we get, especially when we're dealing with maybe a newer client or something like that, is I don't really have anything of value or anything that nobody would want to break in and take any of my stuff, because I really don't have anything of value. Maybe I have some inventory reports or this or that and the other thing, but it's not anything of value. And I said, but it's of value to you. So and you take the word ransomware, and if you have a ransom, most people think of like the movies or TV shows where they take the person's spouse gets taken hostage and they hold them for ransom. Well, that person, God love them, doesn't have any intrinsic value out in the world. There's no value of your spouse out in the world, but they have enormous value, indefinite value, infinite value to you. So the idea that you are going through your business operations and doing that risk assessment that you and I spoke of, the risk is you losing something. It's not whether or not somebody's going to take it and use it someplace else. So really understanding what the value is to you is probably step number one when you're dealing with kind of wrapping all of this together, obviously, the ransomware, the insurance, having that conversation with a trusted advisor, having that internal discussion. Step number one is understanding how much do I have and what is it worth to me? And then starting from there and moving outward and talking to an IT shop, talking to your insurance broker, talking to your business attorney. We find having that internal discussion with people is really the best the best first step for people.
Yeah, excellent. Now, do you have any customer success stories you can share with us? You know, obviously not giving any names or anything like that, but anything in general that you'd like to share with our audience, or any testimonials that you'd like to let us know about?
Yeah, I think one of our best success stories is we have a couple of higher profile clients that have they are really our leaders as far as cybersecurity. They are very in tune with how much data they have and what value it is to their clients. And we have a couple of them that have gone through, one in particular that has gone through an audit as part of their normal business operations. And this is a retirement investment advisor who has adherence to the SEC. So the SEC came in and said, hey, we're going to do a performance audit, a cybersecurity audit. And here's the general outline. Here's where the roadmap takes us on this. And they laid out a roadmap of, it was about 90 days, 100 days worth of back and forth, and we're going to ask these type of questions, and we're going to do fairly standard templated stuff. And we were able to wrap up that 100-day audit in about 20 days. And because we had conversations with the client, because we had been going through this cyber awareness over the past couple of years with them, they really had everything ready to go. They had their written information security plan. They had their disaster recovery plan. We had already done a risk assessment. We had already identified what things we were going to be moving forward with. Because of all that, we were able to provide the auditors with exactly what they were looking for, in a very timely manner, and made everybody's job so much easier. And when the client came back to us and said, we were a little concerned. Obviously, whenever you get a letter from hey, we're going to be doing an audit, most people have a little bit of a holy cow moment. But we were able to turn that around and say, look, we've put in the work. We've gone down this path, and we've got your magical three-ring binder that has the answers in it. And we're able to talk to that, and we're able to show them that this is where we're going, and we've done our homework. And they came back and just thanked us in spades. And it really, for something that we concentrate on and we preach about, we do things like this podcast and we do presentations. We're part of InfraGuard, which is the Philadelphia Cybersecurity Task Force, like the layman side of the FBI Cybersecurity Task Force. And for all of that, it was really heartwarming as a service-based company to have that really come to fruition, and we were actually able to show what we can do.
Is there anything else more you'd like to share with us, sir?
That's probably the most recent. That was a couple months ago, so we were really tickled pink about that one.
Excellent. Now, Chris, there are thousands of other MSPs, MSSPs out there here in this country. What separates you from the rest of the crowd? Why should I say, hey, Chris, I want your services versus X, Y, and Z from all over the U.S.?
So I would say probably two main things. Our unique selling proposition has been for almost 15 years now, our unique selling proposition has been to provide that help, the help that we're first and foremost really concentrating on. But how we do it differently is we're direct, we're expert, and there is no delay. When I say direct, when you call our office, the engineers answer the phone directly. There is no, as we refer to them, there is no Greta gatekeeper who takes a message and has somebody call you back. We don't have any Tommy tryhards on the team. All of our team are level two or higher. They all have 5+ years experience. They're all very well versed in operating in a small business environment. And so when the people, the end users of our clients call, they get an expert. They get somebody who knows their name and who they work for. You're not giving hey, my customer number is 12345. They have 5+ years experience in helping people like you. And thirdly, we are entirely geared towards getting in and getting out as quickly as possible. So we are a flat rate company, and we operate under getting the person operational as quickly as possible. We don't even measure response time, Ravi, because our response time is almost always zero. We actually measure resolution. Resolution time is everything. It's how much time it's going to take to get you having the problem back up and operational again. So those three key things are really our unique selling proposition to our clients. And I think that coupled with the items that we've been talking about and the focus on this cybersecurity and safety has really been a great combination for us over the past couple of years.
Yeah, I think I'll tell you one thing, Chris. I think that human touch is really the human interaction, I think it's really wanted so badly by people now. I mean, in this digital world we live with chatbots and this and that. You know, just having the ability to speak to someone is something that's really very much savored. So my hat's off to you on that. I've talked to other people, yep. And like being Verizon, I mean, I had to talk to their stupid virtualized thing, and I got this text link 3 times, chat with their virtualized bot and all that. But it's going to be customer service. But even then, they still couldn't hear what we're supposed to
do. Yep. But yeah, I use this all the time, Ravi. I say we are the warm voice on the other side of the phone. When you're banging on your keyboard, we are your Zen moment to get you back up and running.
Yeah, I mean, I thought of putting something like a chatbot on my website, but then my I didn't like it because I want people calling me and I want to interact with my clients directly, you know, telling me, you know, face to face what's going on. And I think a lot of people are starting to understand that. I mean, we're so inundated by emails, this and that, you know, we just want to, even the mail, when we get something that's a letter, I mean, it's just something, whoa, hey, I actually got a letter from someone.
It
didn't come by email.
So, it's funny how it's inverted like that over the past 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. But so anyway, do you offer any free trials to, you know, prospects or potential customers, or it's kind of like, here's what you need, and you're just basically, here's what we need, how much it's going to charge, and if you want to join us, you're more than welcome to, or how do you onboard customers?
We usually go out, we do perform an assessment of what, where the client is now, almost like a baseline. So we point out, we call it a BOM report, a BOMB report. So it's really a red, yellow, green kind of report. So it's showing you, here are the things that we've identified that, you know, the things in red, we're going to need to tackle immediately. The things in yellow, we're going to need to address. We're going to create some sort of roadmap for you based on your budget and what the next year looks like. We need to address these things. And here's the things that are green and are okay. So we give them that baseline before they even come on as a client, to give them an idea of what working with us is going to be like. Nobody likes surprises. We try to identify everything ahead of time to make sure that we're showing the clients, look, you've made the indication that you think you want to make things improved in your IT landscape. Maybe there's a production issue. Maybe you want your people to be more productive, and maybe there's a security issue, and you've had a scare or somebody's told you about something and you've heard about something on the radio or TV and you've said, you know what, I need to pay attention to this more. Or maybe one of your clients has made an indication that you need to protect my data as much, and sometimes that comes, you know, trickle-down theory. Whatever the case may be, we want to make sure that as part of that onboarding, we're showing you where we're going to be going, and we're giving you as much lead time as possible to make because sometimes this is an investment. Sometimes there is cost on this, and we want to make sure that we're upfront with people as much as possible.
Okay, excellent. Now, as we come to the last part of our show, I just want to touch on some hot button topics. Let me see. I think one we had talked about was AI, artificial intelligence. I wrote a book on that. It came out about in February. I wrote about machine learning, computer vision, AI, neural networks, and all that. It's a good thing to have, and we know it all involves in the, you know, replicating a thought process of the human brain. But Chris, honestly, we'll never ever do that. I mean, for example, my dad was a professor of neurobiology at Purdue. And he was involved in spinal cord regeneration research, you know, neural transplantation. And he formed the hypothesis that, you know, replacing that brain transplants could be possible, like replacing a memory chip in a computer. But, you know, future research didn't prove that way. But before he died, he was on some kind of breakthrough with using amniotic fluid for, like, cell regeneration of spinal cord. But anyway, his premise was we will never, ever understand what the human brain is like. We may understand how to open heart surgery, but to equate that to neurosurgery, we'll never, never get there. It's just something that we can understand. And I think the term artificial intelligence is such a misused term in cybersecurity on that end. I mean, a lot of vendors push products. Oh, yeah, it's AI. We got that in there. And it just gives the customer a false sense of security. What are your thoughts on AI? I know we talked about that earlier in the show. I think you've even said that you've even used it to some degree in Microsoft Azure. It's an open question. Just run with it. What are your thoughts on it?
I think I'm in agreement with you as far as I don't know that we're ever going to get there. I know there's some dangers to what it can do.
Right.
I think that the the application of where we're seeing it now, particularly in pattern recognition, I think in two uses that we have it right now. We have it both for the endpoint detection response, the EDR. We also have it for the Security Operations Center, which is, if you think like movies and TV, this is like the big room that has all the people that are clacking away on the keyboards and stuff like that. But that artificial intelligence adds, instead of you're just looking at does it match this or does it match that, you're looking for pattern recognition. Does it quack like a duck? Does it sound like a duck? Does it smell like a duck? And that in and of itself, because everything is moving so quickly, I think that's going to be our biggest value. Now, there's always dangers with it. You have, obviously, you go into the sci-fi world of things, and this never works out well when we talk about artificial intelligence. But I think it's the potentials of it are things that are really going to make things better for everybody. There's always a risk with it, and probably one of the biggest risks that I would have would be if I'm going to be giving this artificial intelligence information, how do I know what it's doing with that information? So if I'm going to, if you think of it like a black box, like, okay, I'm giving you something to chew on, I'm giving you something to work on, how do I know if I'm truly in an artificial intelligence, same as if you give a human being a problem to work on, you don't know how they're going to figure it out. You don't know what the output is going to be because the human brain can go in 800 million different directions. The same thing with artificial intelligence. If you give it a thing to work on, granted you construct this, but in true artificial intelligence, you don't know what the output's going to be. You can give some hypothesis, you can give some probability to that, but you don't necessarily know where it's going to go. And so keeping the guardrails up, for lack of a better analogy, is really going to be one of the key things that we're going to need to look at moving forward into this space.
Yeah, one of the biggest cyber risks of AI is what they call deep fakes, where they try to mimic, like, for example, like a politician trying to raise money for a campaign. They mimic
right.
his voice, face, and everything, and actually the money goes to some offshore account. Anyway, yeah. But I think
yep.
one of the biggest benefits of AI is really more like for automation, like for filtering out for false positives. I think it's where companies are really starting to see some great benefit with that. But anyway, another area I want to talk about was the world of IoT, the Internet of Things. I don't know if you've done any work with that in your company, but honestly, I think it's a very scary proposition having so many things interconnected together. I'm an old-fashioned guy. I still drive a Honda, 03 Civic. Everything's all analog instrumentation. I've seen my financial advisor, and this guy drives like a James Bond car, seriously. I mean, it's got four computers in it, four monitors. He even showed me one time he could clap his hands, the car would back out. It's like, geez, you really need all this stuff? It's crazy. And what are your thoughts on all that? I mean, do you have like a smart home or a smart car or anything smart related?
I do. I'm one of those automation guys. So I do have like the light bulbs, and I do have the thermostat, and I do have a lot of that. And it does offer some concerns. I do make sure that obviously I'm security focused, so I do make sure that I have two-factor authentication turned on. And I don't have a whole lot of interdependencies done between things. So I try to keep them isolated. We use a lot of we've moved into a zero trust environment here at Cristo IT, and I know we didn't get a chance to talk about that a whole lot, but that idea of that trust but verify, and I'm only going to allow you to do exactly what you said you're going to do, and I'm not going to give you any escalation of privileges just because you're doing that. Now, that goes for your home thermostat the same as it would for, you know, a Word document in your small business. I'm letting you open Word, and I'm letting you type a letter or maybe even put a hyperlink in there or a spreadsheet, but I'm not going to let you open up a PowerShell command to run something, because that's not the way you're supposed to work. So if you take that, I'm really in favor of letting things progress. I don't know that you can put the genie back in the bottle as far as things are, where things are, you know, being automated and people's appetite for having things, you know, better and more streamlined. But I'm all in favor of isolating and making sure that you only have the ability to do what you said you're going to do. So anything further than that, we need to make sure that doesn't get elevated in any way, shape, or form.
Okay.
I think that IoT is going to be a thing, but I think if you increase that surface area of risk, if you start having things that you know, turn on and turn off and all that other fun stuff, and it's fun, it's exciting, and it makes things better for people. Caution and making sure that things are only allowed what they say they're going to be doing is going to be key.
Okay, excellent. Now, who can forget about COVID, right? So how has that affected you, your business? The remote workforce, you know, this was the concept that was thought maybe 4 or 5 years down the road that would happen, like when you're 99% workforce, but we've seen that happen.
Right.
It's a matter of, what, 2 or 3 months. Mistakes have been made, but what are your thoughts on all that? Is this something that we're going to be seeing now for pretty much forever now? Or do you think we'll see more of a hybrid work model, or what are your thoughts on all that?
I think the hybrid is going to be the answer moving forward. To what degree, I don't necessarily know. Traditionally, over the past 20 years, we had about 20-25% of the people that we supported worked out of the office. Either they were in sales, or they were in a remote office, or they're technical. They're on the road in some way, shape, or form. About 25%. And what we've seen over this past 18 months is that's now about 50%, 60% of who we support are now in a remote area. And that's not necessarily the same 50-60% on any given week. Sometimes, you know, people are doing they themselves are doing hybrid. Sometimes they're working in the office. Sometimes they're working outside the office. I think what this COVID did is it really accelerated 10 years of that progression. And the reason it hurt so bad is because I think this was going to be a natural progression over the next 10 years. I think it just happened all at once. So in our case, we forklifted thousands of end users that we support to work from home over about a 45-day period last year. That was a little painful.
Right.
But I wouldn't want to do it again. It wouldn't be my first choice, but I think this is going to move forward. Now, interestingly enough, we usually had about half and half as far as desktops versus laptops supported. That has gone significantly in the favor of laptops, to the point of maybe a 10-to-1 ratio, where regardless of where it does end up, Ravi, the people want the option to do it. So they're not tied to a desktop in an office anymore. So most of the small businesses that we are, if they're ordering new units, if they're ordering new computers, nine times out of 10, they're ordering laptops to be able to give people the option should they need it.
Well, I think a couple of other lessons learned from this COVID thing is the need for having an incident response plan, business continuity planning, DR planning. And the second thing is I think a lot of the C-suite now, I think they're starting to realize the benefits of having an on-prem solution versus off-prem. You know, I'm talking about like everything up in the cloud,
yep. You
know, putting it in private. But if you need to deploy another workforce like this of another pandemic, you know, like the bubonic plague, hopefully, God willing, will never happen. But if it does, everything's in the cloud. It shouldn't be as drastic or as bad as when we have COVID. As you said, the transition will be a lot easier this time around than it was, you know, the first time around. But talking about the C-suite, yeah, there are – this is still a big hot topic, but every time there's a cyber attack, well, they say, oh, the CISO needs to be fired. I don't think that's the case. I think the poor CISO now is just kind of scapegoat for everything. And what are your thoughts on that? I mean, you're in the C-suite yourself too, so what are your thoughts?
I completely agree. I think the scapegoat is absolutely the right thing. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's the you don't get to pull that trigger if you don't give the person A the power to do things or make changes that are needed, and you don't give it the attention that's required. So back to an earlier point, we were talking about some of the insurance applications and changes in that. Typically, the CISO or whoever is in charge of IT at the business. Now, we outsource and we provide that services, but somebody inside, some employee of the firm, typically either a partner in the firm or an office manager or something along those lines that is handling that CISO role, is working with us to make sure that that happens. But what we've seen on these insurance applications is that they've always asked for who the CISO is. But they're also, secondly, asking for, if you outsource the IT to somebody, who is that firm? Which is a scary proposition when you talk about the accountability aspect of things, because you're not only just asking for the CISO putting their head on the chopping block, but you're also asking for, if they're working with an outside firm, who is that firm? Now, this is where I like to tell the story of my father had a bad blood pressure reading, you know, about 20 years ago, and he's happy, he's all good. But that information went from his doctor up to his insurance company. And it upped his premiums. Not only that, but the insurance companies all share that database of information as far as a bad any kind of health information. So if he were to change insurance providers, it wouldn't matter. He'd still have a higher premium because they all share that information. It doesn't take too much of a rocket scientist to say, you know what, if they're going to share CISO information and they're going to share who the IT providers and from outsourced IT providers information are, that's a scary proposition on as far as a small business is concerned, because I need to make sure that the person who's taking care of my information, either my own employee or the outsourced IT provider, that they have a good clean bill of health and I'm not getting charged additional in my insurance premiums because some other company got breached, and I'm penalized for that. It's going to be that accountability that you mentioned is going to be interesting moving forward, because there, unfortunately or fortunately, when there are charges, when there is a fee or a penalty associated with that accountability, that's when things are going to get really interesting and a lot more visible to the owners out there, the people that are making these business decisions.
Okay, excellent. Now, another hot button topic are these multi-state threat actors, North Korea, China, Russia. In fact, right now I'm working on another book. It's about COVID-19 and kind of like the CISO's pandemic, how too bad. We were just talking about it a few minutes ago. And in my first chapter, I'm going to deep dive into the molecular biology of the COVID-19 virus. My hypothesis is, I'm not afraid to say, I think this was just a lab experiment that went bad in Wuhan, China. They say they came from meat markets and all that. But honestly, I've been in India. You know, their meat markets just as bad or worse. I've never gotten sick from that. And one thing I just discovered when I was doing my research and my writing is that when the first guy was the first known case of COVID, when the Chinese inspected or diagnosed him, they had a lot of information that they did not share with us. And had they done that, I think a vaccine could have come out sooner. So talking about this COVID virus and all that, and my thoughts of that being a lab experiment that went bad in China, what are your thoughts on these nation-state threat actors? Now we're blaming Russia. You know, I'm not going to stay neutral on that because I haven't seen the evidence, you know, for all these ransomware attacks, you know, election meddling. What are your thoughts on all this?
My thoughts are is you got to assume the worst on this. You're never going to find out the answer, unfortunately. It's barely possible to find out the answers sometimes within our own country, let alone try to find out the answers within our external forces. So you really do have to prepare for the worst on that. So I don't know that part of the artificial intelligence thing that we were talking about is if we're going to see patterns of this, is that part of the pattern? Is it going to be patterns in recognizing some of these nation states and seeing some of the the data, like you said, seeing some actual data points as to we're seeing these type of attacks coming from these type of places, and it has these type of signatures, or the things that were written or the bad code have these type of fingerprints, digital fingerprints in them. That's going to be at least one protection that we're going to have against this. The other is going into that zero trust environment. So if I'm going to make the zero trust comes from the idea of just assume that they're already inside your walls. Just assume that they've already made the breach so that even if you share an office with Joe, even if Joe, who's sitting 6 feet from you or in the cubicle next to you, even if Joe sends you an email, you need to verify that Joe sent it to you. Just make the assumption that a bad hacker is sitting in the cubicle across the way from you. And if you make that assumption in that zero trust environment, that's really going to be your best ammunition against, regardless of whatever nation state it happens to be.
Okay, excellent. Another hot button topic, Chris, is data privacy laws, GDPR, CCPA. We talked about that in detail. We did talk about that in detail earlier, but my concern is, like with the CCPA, we're seeing a lot of states now trying to pass their own version of it. I think I saw a couple of headlines where I think some states up north, south, they've kind of come up their own thing. My fear is that we're going to have like 50 different data privacy laws. No company is going to be able to keep track of everything. I'm in favor of having like this one federal mandate. Or for that matter, let's have a Department of Cybersecurity like we had after 9/11. We created the DHS. So why not have a Department of Cybersecurity to keep everything uniform? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm a little bit libertarian by nature on things. So anything federal related really makes me pause for would really want to see what the answer is on it. I would want to see where the direction is on that, and anything that's federally mandated, I'm going to push that down to the state level. I understand that it would be easier to centralize it and you don't wind up with 50 different approaches to the problem, but I really, from a fundamental level, have a problem with centralizing and mandating.
Okay, excellent. Now, as we wrap up our show, what do you think is going to unfold for the rest of the year, cyber threat-wise, going into next year? And what do you tell people? It's like, now, obviously, we all are at risk of becoming a victim. We're not immune to it. But what do you tell people to mitigate that risk of becoming a cyber victim?
Probably the best answer I have for this, Robbie, is step number one is in the NIST framework. Step number one is identify. You really need to know what you have. You need to know, perform an inventory. I'm going to use the word inventory. Just get a reconnoiter of where you are, where your information is. This is either from an individual person or a small business. If I'm talking to a small business owner, where is everything? What do you have? Where is it? Let's get a handle on where everything is, who is actually in your system. Let's do an inventory of all your people. Let's do an inventory of if you have a marketing group or a sales group or an engineering group. Let's make sure that those groups only have access to what they're supposed to. And then you can start actually developing a plan to start getting your protection better. But the first, that identify step number one is the first thing that we always recommend for people, because you can build all the plans in the world, but if you don't actually know what you're protecting first, the protection schemes are going to be based around what we're actually protecting.
Now, finally, Chris, as we wrap up our show, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you in case there's an SMB, there's a business owner, and they say, hey, we want your services. What's the best way for them to get a hold of you? Email, website, phone?
Any of the above. As I mentioned earlier, you can always call our main number. Is it 215-256-7901? And you're gonna speak to one of our engineers. They will be happy to put you in touch with myself or anyone on the sales team here. You can reach us at sales@cristoit.com. That's an email address that can get you in touch with myself or one of our salespeople. And our website, cristoit.com, is up and running. And we right there on the homepage, you can say, hey, I want to talk to somebody. We have a number of free resources as well. Security resources. We have a blog up there. I'd love to talk to you further about some of the ideas that we've talked about, but we have a blog up there with some of the security things that we've really been focused on over the past couple of years that somebody can go and it's free resources that you can get some more information out of.
Excellent. Sounds great. Well, Chris, we thank you for your time. It's really been truly an enlightening a conversation. I learned a lot from it. And I love your, and I think my big key takeaway from this is I just love your approach to dealing with customers and clients, that you just interact with you directly face-to-face right on the first phone call. And I hope that a lot of people will realize that and will take advantage of that fact that you will be out there to help protect their business right off the first phone call. We thank you for your time, Chris, and we look forward to having you on a future podcast.
Been a pleasure, sir. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you. Take care.